This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Before we start the show, a quick note to say that this hour will reference sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's mostly later in the show, and it's not explicit, but just a heads up.
Okay, so let me tell you a quick story of sort of the scariest things that ever happened to me outdoors. I was in high school. I had just come home. I used to work at a movie theater, and so you'd close the movie theater down and get home at like 2 in the morning or something. And I remember walking in from the car, and I just hear from the woods behind our house, and there's nothing back there for a couple acres. It sounded to me like someone hitting a drum. And just 3 beats, 1, 2, 3, and then nothing after that. I remember for weeks after that happened, that just walking in from the car being terrifying.
I think it's fair to say that I could be described as a skeptic. I don't really believe that ghosts or magic or the paranormal exist, at least as it's been described in pop culture. But this did freak me out. Which brings me to a question. What is so scary about the woods? This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today on the show, we explore the connection between nature and fear.
Why are we scared of the woods? Why do all of these spooky stories tend to happen in forested areas?
What ghosts and witches have to do with the woods of New England? First up on the show, a story from the archives, the time when our then executive producer, Maureen McMurray, brought me out on a trip to a cemetery with a pair of ghost hunters.
We got, you know, whispers, we got things that come out of nowhere.
And somebody pulled my hair. Yeah. And you can actually feel it.
I thought he was a lot closer than he was. Somebody blew on my neck.
Ghost hunter number one is nature photographer, screen printer, and ex-motocross racer Rich Dambois.
I always like adventure. I always like the action sports, and I also like hiking and mountain biking, and then it all changed. Somehow we got dragged into the paranormal thing.
Alongside Rich stands a tall, broad-shouldered gentleman with straight, shoulder-length brown hair, blue eyes, and some of the whitest teeth I've ever seen.
Former pro wrestler known as the Candyman, Jerry Seavey.
Shoot her up to the floor! Oh no, the Candyman is down and out!
I did it for 25 years, and I haven't done it in 3 years now because my back screwed up. I broke my nose, broke my sternum. My body screwed up, put it that way.
Rich and Candyman, along with a few other buddies, host a YouTube series called Adventure Cam Paranormal, where they investigate haunted places.
What kind of sensations did you feel?
You could almost feel something lurking in a corner.
Typically, their investigations take place in Victorian mansions and grand hotels, but seeing as we're trying to find out why the woods are scary, we wanted to be outside. So we met them in a cemetery off a forested country road with graves dating back to the 18th century.
So why are we here? Why did we pick here as a spot to see?
Now, have you heard some of the stories about this cemetery?
No, go ahead.
The Blue Lady, supposedly, it was a couple stories of how she might have died. She was either killed by her husband after an argument or a cult killed her, born in the 1700s. She's around here somewhere, but people see a blue light, a column of light. And the other story that I've heard is about a man that had his daughter buried here, and they moved her, and his spirit is walking around looking for her.
If you're picturing one of those kind of weird, super serious, paranormal experts on TV type deals, Rich and Candyman Jerry Seavey are not like that. They're funny and self-aware. Rich says he was a full-blown non-believer until just a few years ago, and he still considers himself to be somewhat skeptical,
at least by paranormal standards. When he's out hunting spirits, he wants proof, and his camera is one of his most trusted tools.
I'm gonna get my laptop. I'm gonna show you some pictures I took here a few years ago, and then one about a year ago. It's just a little strange. You can see it, and this, you know, it's hard to tell. But if you look, like right there.
Yeah, it is hard to see.
Yeah, it is. It's, yeah. Besides, well, I just started showing the devil face got. That was, I think, last year or the year before.
That's creepy.
And that face was just all in the leaves. No editing whatsoever. It was just that perfect face of a devil. Coincidence? Could be. Probably. But you never know.
I couldn't make out the devil face. It just looked like a bunch of leaves. Rich also showed me some other photos that he took in the cemetery.
I'm seeing some orbs here that I cannot explain. Now I'm getting them everywhere. And okay.
And so you're talking about taking photos and there's like orbs of light in the picture that you can't...
Yeah.
That you don't know why they're there?
Correct.
To me, these orbs looked pretty much like little bits of dust in front of the lens getting lit up by a flash. But I'm not a photographer. And Rich, who is, says it wasn't dust. And he says these orbs are an unexplained phenomenon.
Ugh, you're being such a buzzkill, Sam.
I'm sorry. I'm like a skeptical person. I'm sorry.
For me, that's the only place I've been in a cemetery and took pictures that actually started getting a little weird. That, you know, I get a feeling out of it.
Should we wander around?
Yeah.
Candyman handed Maureen a store-bought EMF meter, which measures the electric fields created by electricity, and they're kind of a standby for ghost hunters.
When it goes really high, it means you're getting close, something's getting closer to you.
What's a high number?
Well, last week we were up to what was it, 16, 15, 16? Yeah, 16 was really high.
Because it's at 0.0 right now.
The day we went to the cemetery was bright and sunny. It was just a perfect fall day. And while Rich assured us that hauntings do happen in the day, it was not feeling scary at all.
It's, for some reason, to me, nighttime spooky. I don't know what it is. Like, if you'd have come back late tonight, you'd be wondering what's going on here. I know, like you said, some things come out during the day, but nighttime, for some reason, it's scary. Just like Halloween, people love to be scared. Why is that? I don't know. But the thing is, we love it.
I think both of us, you know, him from wrestling, me from motocross, we miss that adrenaline rush that we used to get in competition. And when we're on our way home, it's just like coming back from a race, like, wow, that was awesome.
I'd do it again tomorrow if I could.
Wrestling or
yeah,
ghost
wrestling.
Hunting?
Okay. Both, actually. Ghost wrestling. No, I would actually. I mean, as much as my I live on ibuprofen, so I'd be popping, always jumping the ring, and because just hearing the voices of the people screaming, it's awesome. It's a great feeling.
It's kind of a leap, but replacing the adrenaline of extreme sports with the fear of ghosts makes sense to me. But the other part, what's causing the fear, that's a bigger question. Why are people scared of the dark? Why are the woods sometimes terrifying? To get those answers, I called someone who's steeped in the stuff.
Hello, this is Aaron.
Aaron Mankey is the host of the podcast Lore. It's all about real history behind creepy stories. He's done episodes on cemeteries, witch trials, abandoned insane asylums, lighthouses, werewolves. So yeah, he knows a few things about spooky stuff. So why don't we just start there? I mean, why do you think we're freaked out by the woods?
You know, I think for a very long time, the wilderness represented the unknown to us, right? So for so much of human history, we've been exploring the world and discovering what's in its unknown parts. And I know we'd like to feel like we have a full understanding of what's out there now. You know, we're modern humans after all. And I think we'd be lying to ourselves though if we said that there was nothing left to learn or explore. So the great outdoors are a beautiful place, but they also hide a lot from us. And I think that's how the wilderness casts that spell of fear over us.
So why do you think people are drawn to stories like that? These stories that can't be proved or disproven.
I think there's a couple factors. I think I think we really want to believe that we're not alone, because yeah, there are six and a half billion of us on the planet, which shouldn't make us feel alone, but we do live pretty solitary lives, and we go through things in our life like loss and separation. And I think to some degree, people believe in stories of ghosts because it gives them hope that there might be something more, that there might be a way to still stay connected to the people that they've lost. But I also think it's just, there's an entertainment value to it, you know, the things that ghosts might do, the noises that they might make in the house, it makes a good story.
This is really graveyardy though. Yeah, they're old, aren't they? Erected in memory of Reverend Abel Fisk, second pastor of the church in Wilton, who died April 21st, 1802, in the 50th year of his age and 24th of his ministry. A good minister of Christ, a kind husband, and a tender parent. An agreeable companion. Aww. Abel.
As we walked along the sun-speckled gravestones, our paranormal experts, Rich and Candyman Jerry Seavey, were coming up empty-handed. No orbs of light, no unexplained whispers, no unusually high EMF readings. Despite the inactivity, Candyman was undeterred. He knows there are other haunted places in the sea.
Like a couple of places, I get this huge chill up my spine. I don't know what it was. It was like, I just seemed like I had to get out of there because it was a weird feeling. But as much as I get these feelings, I still go back for more because I love it. It's like, I don't know.
And you want that, like, yes. That totally off the wall experience.
Yes, I do. Plus, I want to get it on video. So, because a lot of people, Rich and I would tell, they think we're full of it. I've experienced, the reason why I say I know, because I've experienced since I was a kid. My mother first passed away when I was, I think, 14. And she came to see me, so I told people that, and they're like, maybe you're dreaming or something like that. No, I know what I see and what I feel. And my grandfather passed away, then my brother passed away like 2 years ago, and he came to me, and I actually have it on my camera because I was in my living room looking at my old wrestling pitch because he was a wrestling fanatic. He used to go with me all the time because he worked taking the wrestling gear back to the dressing room. So I went to look at him, and there was his face sitting right there. So I'm like, so I started talking to him, Donnie, are you here? But he wouldn't answer me. So I'm getting emotional, sorry.
It's okay.
Whenever I talk about it, I get emotional.
Yeah.
But people say you shouldn't be afraid of the dead. You should be afraid of the living, not the dead. But you don't know if they're gonna hurt you, or they're just like my brother, when he came to me, I know he's not gonna hurt me, but it's like at nighttime when I'm sleeping, you know, the funny thing is I woke up one time and I knew I was awake, and I was trying to call my wife, and it wouldn't come out. And I don't know, you might think I'm full of it.
No, anybody, I don't think, but so here's what I think, here's what I want to ask, is like, do you ever think that it's just the fear and your mind playing tricks on you?
I do. I always think, like my hair pulled, I don't know, it could have been my imagination, your mind plays tricks on people. To prove it to everybody, it's hard, but I believe it.
Hey, hunting's, you know, a good hobby, though.
I love it. And compared to wrestling, being my ass slammed around the ring for 25 years, this is as long as the ghost don't slam my ass.
That was part of Nature is a Haunted House, an episode we originally published in 2016. We concluded with the idea that the link between nature and fear have to do with our collective relationship to the unknown. But up next, let's actually take this in a different direction and find some answers. Into New England's past and the witch trials of the 1600s. That's coming up after a break. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, how the connection between nature and fear can be found in the witch trials of early modern New England.
Here's producer Justine Paradise speaking to Dr. Tricia Pione, program director at New Hampshire Humanities and a historian specializing in early modern history and magic.
I want to sort of set the scene in New England in the 1600s, sort of like right before we get to the witch trials that happened in Salem and in New Hampshire and throughout New England. And I guess particularly around like how people relate to nature. So can you do that for us? Like how do people think about nature in this time in New England?
When English settlers come to New England, they start to talk about how they believe that the indigenous people are involved with the devil. And they literally demonize native people. And this serves a really clear purpose for the English because they are trying to take over this territory. So, you know, it just so happens from their perspective that Satan is colluding with their enemies, which are the French and the indigenous people of New England, in order to overthrow their godly new society that they're trying to set up here. So the English settlers definitely have a view that Satan physically resides in America. So that kind of, you know, it's convenient in a sense that it allows them to say, well, then our enemies here, the indigenous people, are Satan's minions. There was a writer, William Strachey, who in 1612, he's trying to write and encourage people to come to the New World. And he says that the Native American people worship the devil, that they have conference with him, but that if the English come here, God will help them tread Satan under their feet.
Well, given how we know how that sort of turned out over the next couple hundred years, that's quite sinister.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's demonization of the indigenous. And how did that relate to nature and their relationship with, like, the woods?
One of these English travel writers says that the Native Americans worship the devil on toadstools. Like, they make parts of nature into gods. And that all of the gods that they worship and all of the spirits that they worship are actually the devil. So in this case, the devil is taking this a natural form of a mushroom, right? And they're saying that the Native Americans worship that as the devil. So they're kind of willfully misinterpreting Native practices to suit their own agenda here. But they tie in the woods, they tie in the fact that it looks a bit different, the landscape looks different here, and the English believe it's kind of basically a supernatural or haunted landscape because the devil is physically present here. So that's tied with this view of nature as scary. Again, it's unknown space to the English. They're seeing this landscape for the first time. They're trying to conquer it and to dominate it by building things. And clearing the land is kind of their way of pushing the devil out, building houses and clearing the landscape.
Right. So like land that wasn't sort of being husbanded by like a nice heteronormative couple who had like settled, this was marked with suspicion.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So, and then I want to understand how this relates to how then the witch trials took place in New England. Like, how did views of demonization of indigenousness connect to witchcraft?
It does so in a couple of different ways. So for one thing, we see the English accuse Native Americans of practicing witchcraft, of being in a confederacy, in a conspiracy with the devil. But there's also sort of this increased tension that we see right before the Salem witch trials, where the English settlers in Massachusetts and in places like New Hampshire and Maine have been at war with a couple of different native groups for a while at this point. And it's that kind of that warfare that kind of pushes over and boils over a lot of these other tensions. And that ends up leading to, is one of the factors of causing the Salem witch trials, which, as you know, we've got like 200 people accused of witchcraft. So this huge, these mass trials and accusations.
So at this time, witchcraft is sort of defined as a pact with the devil, right?
Right.
So like that means that if native people are kind of agents of the devil and land that's sort of wild is the home of the devil, it's like all connected, like race, nature, and erratic women.
Yes, yes. and so the men and women that come here to New England, they see themselves as needing to be especially careful too, because the devil is physically living here and working with Native Americans and later also with the French, being Catholic, of course. that Puritan New Englanders have to be particularly on guard, that the devil is here more often and he's looking for ways into your soul so that he can corrupt you and get you, especially if you're a woman who's conceived of as weaker, more likely to sin, more likely to want to go to parties with the devil and have him buy you fancy things and sign his book, that you have to be particularly on guard against sin because the devil is really going to try to bring you in to join what they saw is really, like, you could conceive of it as a mass conspiracy theory. That's kind of the way the Puritans viewed it, is they're targeted. They're being targeted by Satan for trying to bring their godly worldview to the new world.
So then this leads to witch trials, or is connected to witch trials throughout New England. We had a couple in New Hampshire that you and I reported on last year.
Right.
And then Salem, where hundreds of people were accused and 20 odd were killed.
25 died as a result of the trials. Yep, 20, 19 hanged, one pressed to death, and five more who died in prison.
In 2019, Justine and Tricia reported a series called The Real Witches of New Hampshire. It was a collaboration between NHPR and New Hampshire Humanities. And today on Outside In, we're going to play the second part of that journey. How did New England move from this time in the 1600s, when fear around nature and the unknown could be so powerful as to drive people to witch trials, to now, this time, 300 plus years later, to a place where people are now openly practicing and selling witchcraft? Here's Justine and Tricia in part two of The Real Witches of New Hampshire.
What do I call myself? I always, when people ask me that question, I always have such a hard time with it, because I know as soon as I say what I think I am, immediately someone's going to have their perception of what I'm trying to say.
Roxy Zwicker is an author, teacher, and artist. She also gives haunted history tours in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, like walking tours and the kind where people get on a trolley and drive around to see all the spooky historical sites.
So I always tell people, at first blush, that I'm pagan and I follow earth-based spirituality. If you want to dig in a little bit deeper, then I will tell you that I do practice witchcraft.
And yeah, she practices witchcraft.
Is that going to skew you now? You're going to be thinking, oh, okay, so, she's going out into the woods and worshiping the devil. I'm not. That's not what I believe. You'll find me at the ocean sitting there meditating. That's what I do. And it's funny, I find sometimes witches know other witches. Like, sometimes we'll finish up a tour and, like, somebody will kind of give you, like, the look. And they're like, oh, I know what you are. They're like, I'm one too.
Roxy Zwicker grew up in Western Mass, and she was the kind of kid who talks to ghosts.
I didn't even realize when I had met my first ghost, because I thought it was a real person. And my mom had asked me about talking to this child that wasn't there. We found out that about 25 years previous, she had drowned in the pond outside where my bedroom window was. And I thought that was really strange. And my mother, once we figured out what was going on, started to explain to me a lot about witchcraft. Now, this was the 1970s, and this was before you could go down the street and buy a tarot card deck. So everything you had to get was mail order.
But Roxy says her mom already had some tools of the craft.
She had tarot cards, she had incense, and right away she started showing me ways to look at the incense and to derive pictures and to do fortune telling.
And she also introduced Roxy to a very significant book.
She took out the big blue, Buckland's Book of Magic.
Roxy had encountered Buckland's Complete Book of Magic with its blue cover and traced white pentacle, written by Raymond Buckland.
Buckland is the man who introduced Wicca to the United States and who brought New Hampshire to the cutting edge of the occult.
So I do think that when people first hear modern witchcraft, perhaps the first thing that people often think of is Wicca. But I kind of feel like this is a big, giant leap that we're making from the summer of 1692 to the 1970s. Can we get a little bit of a sense of what happened, like, right after Salem?
So right after the witch trials, there's actually a couple decades of kind of reckoning with that. Massachusetts ends up paying some reparations to the victims of the witch trials. But really what people mostly want to do in Massachusetts is kind of forget about it.
Nobody wants to talk about the Salem witch trials. You know, this is seen as something that's incredibly embarrassing.
This is Rachel Christ, Director of Education at the Salem Witch Museum. Again, in the decades after the Salem witch trials, so in the early 1700s, there was kind of a collective silence about the whole thing.
You know, to whatever degree of guilt people are acknowledging, there is kind of this general consensus that something went wrong. Innocent people had at least been accused, if not executed. And basically, there was even a like legal ban that the governor put out that said you can't publish about the Salem witch trials anymore. We're done talking about it. It's over and we're moving on.
There's even kind of an erasure, like the trial records were destroyed, and a couple of judges who were meticulous diary keepers and kept a journal for every year of their life, except for 1692, so that disappears. Mm. And over the next couple hundred years, a few things changed dramatically. For one, the government and our legal system.
It's not necessarily a direct connection, you can't draw a straight line, but I think that it would be a massive oversight to say that the kind of reminder of the injustice of the Salem witch trials didn't impact our judicial system as it was being formed.
You can see if you look at the Constitution, you look at the Bill of Rights, some of those are speaking directly to some of these legal problems of the Salem witch trials, right? So you have a right to a trial by jury, you have the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment.
Right.
So these legal changes in the 18th century are actually speaking to some of these injustices in the past.
But how do witchcraft and magic specifically start getting less scary for people?
Well, the second thing that changes is our scientific understanding of natural phenomenon and illnesses. Part of the whole 17th century worldview is about the unknown and trying to assign explanations or causes to the unknown. And when we get into the 18th century, there's just more natural phenomena that's understood.
Mm.
So, you know, thunder and lightning aren't necessarily showing God's displeasure. Now we understand that lightning is a form of electricity that magically comes, I mean, less magically comes from
right.
the sky, right?
So science has sort of marched on a little bit, has developed.
Yeah, and in the meantime, in literature, there are new genres being invented. So, for instance, Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein, which is really one of the first horror and the first sci-fi kind of novels. And then in the United States, you have writers like Edgar Allan Poe, who really popularizes horror stories for the American audience, and he's also super interested in the occult.
I've told you that I'm not mad. Does madness render a man's consciousness this acute that he can see?
So the last thing I'd mention is stage magic. The whole point of stage magic is to demonstrate that magic is not real, that it's an illusion. So you're paying to be tricked, and sometimes the performer even shows you how it's done. New Hampshire had its own very famous magician and ventriloquist, Richard Potter.
He imitates all kinds of birds and beasts so that few or none will be able to distinguish his imitations from the reality.
So by the time we get to the 1930s, the collective idea of witchcraft has completely changed. For instance, the only person convicted of witchcraft in New Hampshire back in the 1600s, Eunice Cole, gets exonerated by her town in 1938 in this big public ceremony. And in 1934, across the Atlantic in London, Raymond Buckland is born.
Hello, my name is Raymond Buckland, and I would like to take you on an historical journey. A journey starting back in Paleolithic times and coming forward through to the present day.
These important occult people have been here. For some reason, their paths have taken them through New Hampshire.
This is J.W. Oker. He lives in Nashua, New Hampshire, and he's an author. When we asked him what he writes about, he summed it up as...
spooky stuff. So I write travel books, first-person travel books, my adventures visiting odd things.
He's a contributor to Atlas Obscura and the author of travel books of haunted and macabre sites across New England, including the New England Grimpendium.
Raymond Buckland, Aleister Crowley, they were drawn here for some reason. Again, New Hampshire doesn't have a huge press kit. Like, if they go to London, like, oh, great, London. If they go to New York, like, of course they went to New York. If they go to Egypt, oh, obviously they went to Egypt. But they went to New Hampshire, too.
And one of those people is, of course, Raymond Buckland, speaking here in a documentary called Witchcraft, Yesterday and Today.
I was myself responsible for introducing Wicca, Gardner's branch of it, to the United States, having been initiated by his high priestess only the year before he died. This was a time when there was no modern witchcraft visible in this country.
He basically is the father of Wicca in the U.S. He brought it to the U.S. more or less. There's always contestations around this kind of things, but he was the guy who brought it to the U.S. in the 60s, started his own kind of sect, that kind of thing. But he studied under Gerald Gardner, who is the actual capital F, capital W, father of Wicca in London.
In 1954, a book appeared titled Witchcraft Today. It was written by a Dr. Gerald Russo Gardner. In the book, Gardner said, in effect, witchcraft was a religion, and in fact, it still is. I know because I'm a witch.
So Gerald Gardner, he is, quote unquote, the father of Wicca. But what is Wicca?
So the basic structure of Wicca is it's a duotheistic religion. They worship a god and a goddess, and it's earth-based. They celebrate the rhythms of the year. They celebrate the seasons through festivals that you've probably heard of, like Samhain, which falls around Halloween, Yule, which falls around Christmas, Beltane, which is a spring, like early May festival. And Wicca's organized into covens. Each coven has a high priest and a high priestess, and the only way that you can become Wiccan is by being initiated into a coven.
Okay. But Gardner is the father, so what does that mean?
So Gerald Gardner was really the first person to describe Wicca, and he does that in a book he called Witchcraft Today. And in this book, he describes Wicca as a pre-Christian, Paleolithic, very ancient religion that survived essentially unbroken, that it was transmitted through the ages by surviving in families in different parts of Western Europe.
So he was sort of claiming he was rediscovering this, like, sort of lost or secret thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So historians and anthropologists who look at this idea of a hereditary form of witchcraft and these traditions surviving from pre-Christian, pre-industrial times. You know, there's evidence for some of it, but not all of it. It's both modern and ancient, you know, so he's drawing on some ancient traditions and sources, but he's filling in the rest with like 19th century folklore.
So is there any reason that Gardner published his book in the 50s? Like, why this moment?
Yeah, there's a few reasons, but I think one of the really critical ones is the fact that England repealed a law against witchcraft in 1951. So there was still a law on the books from the period of the witch trials that made it a crime to claim to have magical powers.
Wow. So then when he publishes his book in 1954, like you're drawing that connection?
Yeah, so it's legal to claim to practice, you know, to claim you have magical powers to practice witchcraft. And you could have potentially been prosecuted for it prior to 1951 in England.
So Gardner can say, I'm a witch in his book, which he publishes in 1954. And in fact, in America, just a year before, in 1953, Arthur Miller also published his play, The Crucible, which was inspired by the Salem witch trials. And it was seen as an allegory for McCarthyism.
Why does she see you out there?
She sees nothing!
She sees nothing!
Have you compacted with the devil?
Never! Never! Never!
Why must they...
So, amazingly, around the same moment that attention is beginning to return to Salem and the witch trials, a form of modern witchcraft is also beginning to come out into the open.
Wicca really opens the floodgates. And this is partly because of Raymond Buckland. Because while Gardner required new members to be initiated by a high priest and priestess, Buckland says, you can initiate yourself and start your own coven. So people start doing that.
So this brings us back to the early 70s when Roxy's Wicker was growing up and encountering Buckland's Complete Book of Magic, which tells you how to do it all.
Yeah, so there's access to the tools of magic. An interest in the occult is growing. Teenagers are playing a new game, Dungeons and Dragons, and they're seeing depictions of magic and the occult on TV and in film.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world.
Is that what you want, Count Dracula? A last blaze of utter horror and violence? Ghastly annihilation of an entire planet? Is this your own death wish?
The TV show Bewitched even films a couple episodes in Salem, Massachusetts.
Isn't this the place where they held the witch trials?
One of them. Let's drive on.
As long as we're here, wouldn't you like to go in?
Darren? That's like asking Napoleon if he'd like to revisit Waterloo.
And in this moment in the early 70s, this moment of renewed interest in magic and the occult, Raymond Buckland moved to New Hampshire.
Yeah, so Buckland had been practicing for years, and he had collected occult objects. He started a museum of this collection on Long Island, but after his divorce in the early 70s, he moves to, of all places, the lakeside tourist town of Weir's Beach in New Hampshire.
Literally, you'd go there, you'd hit the beach, you'd go to a Ferris wheel ride, then you'd go see the witchcraft museum.
The Buckland Museum of Witchcraft and Magic was in New Hampshire from 1973 to 1976. It moved around and in and out of storage, and now it's on display in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where J.W. Oker got to see it.
The interesting thing about his collection, so when you think witch museum, especially in New England and in Europe too, you think of museums dedicated to the tragedy of witch trials. So it's a much different experience.
Not much is known about the museum while it was in New Hampshire. But the current director, Stephen Intermill, explained that the collection mostly includes artifacts from the neo-paganist movement in the United States.
Probably like one of my favorite pieces to talk about is we have a mandrake root that is estimated to be about 200 years old. We only know the date because of its size. They tend to get poached before they're this big. It's carved to look like a woman carrying children, so it's probably actually used in magic to help with fertility. And that is really special. And we have a lot of stuff going back to Ray's early coven.
In the back, he has a, or the collection has a box with a rim of salt around it that's supposed to contain a demon that Buckland summoned on accident one time and had to contain it in this box. And they have like a drawing of the demon. It's a fun thing. It's like lighted weird. It's like a little like kind of groovy lighting around it. But mostly it's a legit historical artifacts of witchcraft all the way around it.
One of the things I love to point out is the DIY nature of a lot of the artifacts that we have, because Wicca as a religion is a religion of DIY. You do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. So you actually went to the site, too.
I did. It's kind of a nondescript building. It looks like it was a bar, but now it's vacant.
So no remaining traces of magic?
Nothing that I could see.
But for a moment in the 1970s, Weir's Beach was on the magical map.
Since then, there have been plenty of offshoots of neo-paganist traditions. Just to name a couple, in Massachusetts, the official Witch of Salem, Lori Cabot, started her own tradition. And in Salem, New Hampshire, there's also the Temple of Witchcraft, founded in 1998.
Once upon a time in New Hampshire, for 3-4 years, we had the only occult museum in the country. You know, there's a guarantee in the 70s there wasn't that many. So at one point in time, Weir's Beach kind of was the place you want to go to see cool stuff like that.
Was actually cutting edge very briefly as far as occultism in the 70s.
Cutting edge occultism, right.
But we should also go back to another figure who deeply shaped the transformation of not only the perception and practice of witchcraft, but also the modern world.
He was also known as the wickedest man in the world, and that's a title that he absolutely relished and loved.
And this person also passed through New Hampshire.
That's coming up in just a minute on Outside In. Quick reminder that this episode references sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the upcoming story. There's also a reference to violence against animals. This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and here's Justine Paradise and Dr. Tricia Pione on The Real Witches of New Hampshire.
So this is, look, there's Little Bee. This is our Holy Basil garden.
A little while ago, we spent a very serene morning in a garden in Hampstead, New Hampshire.
We were harvesting tulsi, or holy basil, with Erica Shukimas and Veronica Light.
So all we're going to do is just kind of just listen and then harvest the top.
Oh, I smell that.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, it's just so sweet.
I feel like as soon as I smell it, just in this form, I can just breathe. I take a deep breath.
Erica and Veronica are the witches behind Spiritwise Herbs. They make plant-based remedies like salves, tinctures, and Erica's specialty, moonflower essences.
Being a witch has everything to do with how you walk in your daily life. And there is a witch's creed. For me, the most powerful is really like the last line. And harming none, do what ye will.
So you might describe Veronica and Erica as green witches. They're not Wiccan, but they're pagan and they work with the earth. But there are many, many ways to practice modern magic.
I want you to take that napkin you have in your hand right now, and I'm going to do a little chaos magic for you folks tonight. Is that okay?
That's all right? Nate Higgins, program manager at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and modern occultist.
And here he's performing in a drag show as his alter ego, Bunny Wonderland.
Whether you believe in magic, whether you believe in drag, whether you believe in yourself, hail yourself, whatever it might be, I want you to just take all the bull that you've had from today, from this week, from this month, from this year, and let it go into the f***ing air, okay? Earth, air, fire, water, I don't really care.
Magic, to me, is using energy and your will to bend the will of the world and to create things that were once not there.
The practices of magical people like Erica, Veronica, and Nate are connected and overlapping in some ways and quite distinct in others. But as Veronica and Nate each describe their definitions of magic and witchcraft, they both use the same key word, will.
The fact that they both use that word reveals the influence of one of the most important figures in the history of the occult, a person who had a huge influence on pop culture, Aleister Crowley.
I mean, I've studied lots of different systems of lots and lots of different systems of magic. And I found a lot of them kind of come back to a lot of them come back to Aleister Crowley. He was one of the foremost occultists, probably the foremost occultist of our entire like generation lifetime.
Aleister Crowley is this massive presence in the occult.
That's G.W. Oker again.
But a faraway presence, right? He's British, right? He's one of those British figures like Alfred Hitchcock. In America, you think of them as bigger than life and far away from you, right? In history and in time.
Crowley founded a religion before Wicca in the early 1900s. He called it Thelema.
So it's really hard to know exactly what he did, even though he wrote so much about it. And magic in general is hard to parse. It's all ritualized, but it's really kind of difficult to understand.
And there is a lot of mystique around Crowley. So what we can say about him is that he was a person who was very good at creating a public image and a sense of drama.
So I think he kind of set a modern precedent, not just for not being ashamed of what he wanted and what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it, but being good at interacting with the press, setting himself up with a persona.
He was also known as the wickedest man in the world.
The wickedest man alive. Somebody else gave him that name, and he just embraced it with both arms. Another one was the Beast.
His mother used to call him the Beast. Six, six,
six. His kind of hedonistic take on life definitely was mostly verboten during his time, during the early 20th century.
Crowley slept with both men and women. He experimented with sex and with drugs, and he incorporated both into his rituals and philosophy.
Well, I mean, his Confessions of a Drug Fiend, where he, you know, intimately described his drug practices, you know, would get mirrored by, like, you know, Hunter S. Thompson and all those guys later on.
But he wasn't just an occultist.
He was a poet. He was an incredible mountain climber, like huge, like expedition, like huge, and huge records of it as well too. But he just knew so much about so many different things. He was kind of a genius.
He did a lot of world traveling. But the fact that he spent 4 months in New Hampshire is fascinating. All the places he could go, and he went to Egypt, he went to very exotic places, and he picked New Hampshire for 4 months.
Aleister Crowley did come to New Hampshire to ghostwrite for an astrologer.
In New Hampshire, he had a contact, Evangeline Adams. She was a noted psychic and astrologer of the time. So when he wanted a magical retirement, is what he called it, because again, he loved drama, so he couldn't just take a vacation or go away for a few months. He had to name it, had to make it a thing. He chose her cabin in Hebron, New Hampshire.
He was there. He apparently made a canoe. He did a lot of his writing while he was there.
Writing, practicing magic. It was pretty much a low-key time for him, honestly.
I mean, kind of. His diaries described him, like, he wrote about this. This is what he said he did. He said he captured a frog, ritualistically crucified it, and ate it.
That's not your typical New Hampshire vacation, I would say.
They do not put that in the brochures.
He loved the how away from it all was.
So Crowley appears in pop culture in a lot of places, but perhaps most especially in rock and roll.
Ozzy Osbourne has a song about him. The Rolling Stones mentioned him. David Bowie. Obviously Led Zeppelin is the most connected to him.
He's on the cover of the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Part of rock and roll's quote-unquote classic rock was kind of opening up morals and social mores. Drugs and free sex and that kind of thing. So that's directly from Aleister Crowley. But also, again, self-fashioning, that persona building of that every rock star has to do, that David Bowie was so great at. They took him as a template. Like, how do we be bad guys but still have culture kind of not hate us? And that's exactly what, you know, all those guys did.
Aleister Crowley died in 1947.
And he's still very much a controversial figure now than he was, you know, over 100 years ago.
Despite, or perhaps even given, Crowley's larger-than-life influence, his legacy is complicated.
I don't know. I always took everything about Aleister Crowley sort of with a grain of salt, and I think there's lots of ways to look into the history of him and feel kind of icky and kind of weird and gross.
Yeah, there are criticisms of Aleister Crowley. For example, some of his writing certainly reflects misogyny. He says racist things in his writings. And there are people who still consider him to actually have been, you know, the devil or an instrument of Satan.
So while Crowley's influence is definitely really powerful, Nate does make his magic his own. He practices what's called chaos magic.
Chaos magic. Chaos magic is, that's a very good question. It's a, it's sort of the philosophy that everything is nothing and nothing is everything, sort of the Tao of witchcraft.
Chaos magic revolves partly around setting an intention on a symbol.
And you set it aflame with either an excitatory practice or an inhibitory practice. So excitatory practice would be like playing music around it, dancing with it, taking it to the club, you know what I mean? And then there's also inhibitory methods, so meditating with it, doing sensory deprivation, and holding it there. So using both extremes of energies to activate and know that both extremes do activate.
We visited Nate's apartment in Portsmouth where he showed us his altar space.
So altar space is here. All my books, most of my books. There's like a whole shelf for kind of herbs and then things that are used a little bit more practically in certain applications, and then bones or totems or animal stuff is up here. And these are, again, all found naturally wild. Somebody just brought me this beautiful turtle bone from Thailand.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, people would bring me wasp's nests, and I would trade them snake skin for wasp's nests. And then more of our ceremonial kind of stuff is up here. I have stones from Avebury Stone Circle, some grass and some clippings from the inner stone circle of Stonehenge. Spells and things that I tend to be working or active usually tend to go on top of the stuff. So
part of Nate's excitatory practice happens on stage in a public and communal experience. It's kind of hard to imagine happening before the mid-20th century. Nate, again, is a drag queen and performs in his character, Bunny Wonderland.
For the one, the only Queen of Portsmouth, Bunny Wonderland.
I usually ask the audience, I say, you know, if you don't want to participate in, you know, we're going to do a little magic. And if you don't want to participate in that, you don't have to. You don't have to do that at all. One of my favorite ones to do with a group of people is to do a banishing ritual. And a banishing ritual is basically when you are just banishing something from your life, whether it's good, whether it's bad. Sometimes we need to just banish or neutralize our feelings. And so I love the song Since You've Been Gone. By Kelly Clarkson, and I found a really beautiful version of it by Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox. And I just say, you know, at this song, while I'm performing this for you, take all the bullshit that you have in your life, feed it through me, I'm the conduit, let my performance be your, let it be your sanctuary in this moment. We're all here together in this room. So if we have a collective energy together, we can banish whatever we want from our lives. So let me banish that for you. And so that's all you'd ever hear me say. Since you've been gone. Since you've been gone. I can't breathe for the first time. And I ask everyone just to be incredibly quiet during the performance, like, so don't hoot and holler. And then at the end, that's when you can hoot, that's when you can holler, clap, go crazy. And usually by the end, people are crying. Or have given their all, have gone there with you. How can I put it? You put me on. I even fell for the stupid love song. Yeah. Since you've been gone. Since you've been gone. How come I never hear you? We'll be right back.
That's it for Outside In today. This episode included work produced by Maureen McMurray, Justine Paradise, Dr. Trisha Pione, with me, Sam Evans-Brown, Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon, Jimmy Gutierrez, Ben Henry, Daniela Ali, Hannah McCarthy, Sarah Ernst, and Taylor Quimby. Our executive producer is Eric Janik. Maureen McMurray is director of the Alternative Lightning Theory Department. The Real Witches of New Hampshire series was a collaboration between NHPR and New Hampshire Humanities and was produced with support from Anthony Poor, Becky Kinnan, and Morgan Wilson. You can listen to the rest of the series by looking up the podcast, The Second Greatest Show on Earth, or by visiting nhpr.org. Music in this episode came from Blue Dot Sessions, Yacht, Jan Terrian, Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox, Daniel Birch, Jazzar, and Uncanny Valleys. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.